Won't be the fourth
time. What's going on, y'all? Leave me alone. This is my intro. This is the best thing I do. That would be Mr. Briscoe right now beneath me or wherever he is on these Brady Bunch squares. And you've got one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. But his character that was created is something that will live forever. An iconic character in WWE history. I know how great it was because I stole his gimmick. Welcome to the Million Dollar Man, Mr. Ted DiBiase. Ted, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys. I'm telling you, man, it really is.
It's hey, awesome. Teddy, I got one thing. Since I got both of you billionaires on the line here, can I get a loan, a low interest loan, maybe an interest only loan?
Checks in the mail.
check with JBL, right?
I don't know if you saw how Ted and I handled money and on the television, but we probably weren't the best people to borrow money from.
Me not. Absolutely not.
Talk about predatory rates.
Hey, Teddy, man, it's great to have you on here, man. John and I were talking about it, and he gets so excited sometimes. What we enjoy most about the show, we have our friends on here. We have guys and girls on here that, you know, mean a lot to us, that's been down the road with us a little bit, and that we have a lot in common with. And your background and John's background, you know, West Texas State and Abilene Christian and all that stuff, they just go together. We've had so many guys. We've had the great Stan Hansen on, you know, and that was one of those West Texas outlaws out there. Now we got the outlaw that made the most money, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. Man, it's a pleasure. But, you know, all three of us have a few connections, and it's basically the way you started out there for those egg-sucking dog funk family out there. So, you know, West Texas football player and an egg-sucking dog. Tell us a little bit about, you know, when you made that transition from West Texas over to the pro side.
Well, I have known the Funk family since I was very young. My dad, Iron Mike DiBiase, who also was not only a pro wrestler, but
a Big Eight champion, man. Big Eight champion. And you guys, ladies and gentlemen, worldwide, you might not know what college football is over in Greece or Italy or any of those foreign countries over there. I hope I'm being PC here, but these two Texans right here just killed American college football, and they're proud of it. And they all did it all for what? Money, 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 money. So tell us your story.
Hey, Jessica. Somebody once said, everybody's got a price.
That's right. Oklahoma State does it.
We do, but they can't go that low, man.
Ted,
but anyway, my relationship with the Funks goes all the way back to my childhood when 1966, I believe, I spent the summer in Amarillo, Texas. My dad was wrestling there. We went back to Nebraska for a couple of years. And then in the summer of 69, we left Nebraska. My dad's plan was to, you know, put me in a good Texas high school football program, the best high school football program in the entire country. Put me in one of those schools and see how I did, because I had done real well my freshman year in Nebraska. And anyway, that summer he died, heart attack in the ring, and he died. I finished high school out in Southern Arizona. I was looking at TV one day, and the wrestling show out of Amarillo comes on locally in Tucson, and they were trying to make a move and see if they could work Arizona. Anyway, I went to Tucson. Dory Sr., Jr., Terry were all there. Terry talked me into taking a recruiting trip. And he said, even if you already decided what you want to do, just take the trip, come back, see everybody. And that's really all it took. You know, I mean, it was in my blood. It's the one thing I've always wanted to do. I wanted to be with my dad. And so I went to West Texas State in the fall of 1972. And I was there 3 full years. And then the summer between my junior and senior year, a guy named Dick Murdoch says, hey, he says, I'm going to work for Bill Watts in what they call Mid-South territory. Now it's big territory. He's you know, he's hooked up with Leroy McGuirk and they've expanded the territory. And he says, you might get your feet wet and find out if you really want to do this stuff. And I said, that'd be great. Well, it was great till the end of summer. When the end of summer came, I had done well enough that I was like, why do I need to go back to college? This is what I want to do the rest of my life. Now, to this day, I still regret that. I had one year of college left. And, you know, by the grace of God, I never I didn't really want to be a teacher, a teacher and a coach. I wanted to be a wrestler. So that's when I started the summer of 75, working for Bill Watts. And, that was pretty good too, because Bill Watts is a pretty, photographic memory. That guy's sharp as a tack, mean as a bull, but sharp as a tack. And I learned a whole lot about the psychology of wrestling from Cowboy Bill Watts. Yeah, I hate to admit that because he's another one of those Okies,
Kid, I've told Jerry for a long time, we need a wall. Not like Trump says on the border between us and Mexico, but between us and Oklahoma. Get all the Okies out of the promised land of the great state of Texas.
There you go, man.
And that's about the only thing I agree with Layfield on. Is put that damn wall up so we can keep those damn Texans out of Oklahoma.
And Jed, your mother was a wrestler also, right? Helen Hild, was that?
That's right. Her wrestling name was Helen Hild. I think that's actually how she met my dad. I mean, because Mike was not my biological father. My mom divorced my real dad when I was two, and he was a professional singer. And, I don't know how she got into wrestling. I never asked that question, but anyway, somewhere along the way, she met Mike and they got married in October of 1959. And I was 5 years old. And that's when I, hit the road, so to speak. I'm just like, wrestlers moved a whole lot back then. I mean, that's first grade. I was in Amarillo, Texas for a semester, and then I was in Portland, Oregon, the second semester of school. Then in second grade, I was in Houston, Texas. I was there for the whole year. Yeah, back to Texas. And then, third grade, Arizona, fourth, fifth grade, Omaha, Nebraska, sixth grade. Back to Texas.
Wow.
We kept going back to Texas.
People just don't understand the schedule that generation had. Fortunately, I come along the next generation after that, where we kind of picked a territory, and we kind of if you got over there, you worked a deal with a promoter, and you kind of homesteaded the place, as they used to call, and you just work in areas. But Teddy, you were one of those guys that kind of, Bill Watts in Japan, that was so central, and everything. But you also worked like Florida. You worked a little bit in the Carolinas. You worked Georgia. I know you were a star in Georgia when I was there. And you worked Missouri. The place that everybody wanted to work was St. Louis. And going back to your dad, Mike, didn't he beat Bob Geigel in the finals of the Big Eight tournament, I believe. Isn't that correct?
I think so.
So that's the reason he won the star in Kansas City.
He was the AAU National Heavyweight Wrestling Champion
right.
in 1946.
Right.
And that was like right after World War II. Yeah. And then at Nebraska, he lettered eight times, 4 years in football, four in wrestling, and 3 years in a row, he was a conference heavyweight champion.
Wow, what a phenomenal athlete! And I remember when I was just getting started, and I was kind of guys would go over, some of the guys that made that transition from amateur. Your dad was always at the top of the list, along with Danny Hodge. And I always thought, that guy must have been.
Hey, Gerald, my first TV match was with Danny Hodge.
Wow.
I was scared to death.
I don't blame
you. I had heard all these stories about the grip. Don't let him get a hold of you, man. All the boys are. They ripped it right up. And you know what? Right. He was just as easy as it could be. But what a great guy.
What a great loss the business had when we lost Danny Hyde, because truly a legend there. But you know, that like you were talking before, the guy jumping around everywhere, and it was hard to build friendship with anybody, you know, because you were gone all the time. But when was it? Where it had to be? Where was you finally when you got, you know, okay, I'm here and I'm going to get my football career started here and play for next level football?
Well, I was, like I said, I was watching TV. I was at a small school in Southern Arizona, a little town. I mean, three traffic lights, Wilcox, Arizona. And Wilcox is 80 miles from Tucson. And I had signed a letter of intent to play for the University of Arizona. And then that's, like I said, the wrestling show came on. I go and see the Funks. Next thing you know, I've decided I'm going to go to West Texas State. And then, so in the summer of 75, which would be the summer right before what would have been my senior year of college, I just jumped in with both feet. And I was at the time working for Bill Watts. And I worked for Bill all the way to the next summer. And then I made my first trip to Japan in the summer of, like, I think it was 76. Mm-hmm. And I was over there. And of course, you know, I think the Funks booked a lot of the stuff for Baba.
Right.
And I got my first taste of Japan. That was the longest 5 weeks of my life.
That's the thing. Back in those days, you didn't go for any 3-day tours to Japan. You didn't go for a week tour to Japan. My first tour over there was 6 weeks, brother. And I didn't think that 6 weeks would ever end. You know, just every night. You know, it's like you just, you know, I remember being over there and just thinking, are we ever going to get a day off?
Yeah, no kidding.
But you know, what an experience. And you know, I'm like you, man. You can't buy those experiences like that. Yeah. So, is that when you first teamed up with Stan? Or
no, I didn't team up with Stan until much later. You know, he and Bruiser Brody. You know, another West Texas.
Yes, sir. Another
football player. You know,
state person. before you go on real quick, how many other guys were there before you go on with Brody? Brody was there. Hanson was there. Tully was there. You had, I think Dusty went there.
Oh, my gosh.
Bobby Duncombe,
both the Funks, Stan Hanson, and then me and Tully Blanchard and Tito Santana were all on the same team. And then Barry Windham. I know I'm leaving some, but Manny Fernandez is another guy. They all played football at West Texas State.
And Dick Murdoch played in all the alumni games.
Dick Murdoch told everybody he did, but he never played it down.
He didn't play one down.
He never went to college.
He was an honorary West Texas football player.
Yeah, there you go.
An honorary letterman there. Did you say you played with Tully?
Yeah, I played with Tully.
Is it true that Tully threw a football into a tuba of the opposing team's band during a third down?
Yeah. You know what?
But you can't tell that story again. He with Tully.
He came back and we had a match, and I think in cutting the promo, I said something that he was so, you know. He was just distraught because, you know, he had set an all time record, most interceptions in a season.
That'll make it distraught.
I saw an interview you did, Ted, with, I think it was our friend Sam Roberts, where you're talking about the Funks were out of town and they asked you in college to take Andre out.
Oh my God.
The story. This is
Terry and Junior took over the territory after their dad died, and I had just been working a very short time, but after that first year I went back to Amarillo and worked the territory. And so they said, look, they Andre the Giant's coming in, they said, we're gonna all be out of town. I said, you know, would you be willing to take him out? And I wasn't even in the business yet. I was still in college. And so, yeah, I'd be happy to. So, my gosh, man. So I took him to one of the places where all the, you know, the college kids went, you know, and so this barmaid comes up and says, what do you have? And Andre looks at her and goes, you have trash can? And she looked at him and she said, yeah, we got a lot of trash cans, a big trash can. She said, yeah, we do. She says, empty trash can, put 5 cases of beer on ice and bring it to the table. She looked at me like, is he serious? And I said, yeah, do it. I mean, you know, and again, Andre's hands were so big. If he just wrapped his hand around a can of a beer, you couldn't see it. Wow. He was huge, brother. Just huge. But what a great guy. Wow. Not a nicer story, guy.
The story I also heard, I saw, I think, with you, with Booker T, were telling the story about Andre in the elevator in Japan. I don't know what
you. That's my favorite story. Now, you know, I tell people, I said, you know, HBO did, I thought they did a pretty good job of making, you know, the public or fans understand just how difficult life was for Andre because of his size. I mean, you know, John, you and I can sit in a coach seat, but it ain't comfortable. Don't like it. Well, you put Andre in a first class seat on a 14-hour flight. That's like, you know, that's like us sitting in coach. He's not comfortable. And so anyway, we go to Tokyo. And, you know, 14 hours, and then it's another hour into the city, and so everybody was going to freshen up, you know, we're going to meet in the lobby and go out and eat, and you stay awake as late as you can the first night, because if you don't, you're going to be asleep at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And so I remember I hit the elevator button, the door opens, and there's Andre. Hey, boss, let's go eat. So we start down, and this elevator stops at virtually every other floor. Now, 3 stops ago, you and I would have said, this elevator's full, get the next one. Not in Japan. Mm-hmm. I mean, they pack them in Japan. I mean, the whole country's the size of the state of California. And of that landmass, 3/4 of it is uninhabitable mountains. But the population of Japan is about half that of the United States. So they stack them in, man. And so anyway, Andre reaches over and just gives me a little tap on the shoulder. And I looked up at him and he winked. I said, okay, something's going to happen here. Well, buddy, that the next thing you heard was the loudest, longest fart that I have ever heard in my life. I remember thinking, I'm staring straight ahead, both, you know, biting a hole in my lip. And I said, I know it's the giant, but how could any human possibly have that much air in their body? And I could just picture the poor Japanese guy that's standing directly behind him, getting it right in the face. But I'm going to tell you what, when the elevator door opened again, it was like the Exodus. They were tripping over each other to get out the door. And they were all, you know, well, they had to be cussing the big guy, you know, because they, you know, obviously, you know, they weren't very happy. But as the doors closed, it was just me and Andre. And all you could hear was, oh, oh, that big laugh of his. And he looked down at me and he says, I guess they won't crowd the big man anymore, will they? I love that guy.
Another guy that we all love, Dick Murdoch. Jim Cornette once said about Dick Murdoch, Dick Murdoch is the wrestling what a trick shot artist is to pool. He gets there, but he gets there in a way you never figured out how to get there. It's just Dick was so talented. But oh, crazy. That
has John, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's like I can remember this was before I was wrestling, the summer before. So the summer between my sophomore and junior year in college. Now, you know, at that time you couldn't be paid in a professional sport and maintain your amateur status. So I didn't wrestle, I refereed. And that was a pretty good education too, being the third man in the ring. And what was the whole point?
Dick Murdoch about how he'd get to the right conclusion, but he'd get to the roundabout.
I went up and down the roads with him, and he could have a great match so easily. And I'm in the ring with him, and he's cutting jokes. He, you know, it's like, it's almost like he's, and I don't know, it's hard to explain. I mean, it's kind of like the, you know, at the time, you know, he was a heel And the crowd wanted to kill him. And he's making me and the other guy he's working with laugh in the ring. It's just unreal. It was so easy for him. You know, it was almost like second nature to him. He was really that good. But you're right. You know, you never could figure him out. You know, of course, one of his mentors was, you know, another guy that I had a great deal of respect for, Killer Carl Cox, who was another great wrestler. You know, he and Cox and Murdoch had an unbelievable run and a feud in Mid-South. So
anyway. They had a feud everywhere they went. I was fortunate enough to be a tag team with Cox a few times when he actually turned babyface down here in Florida. But I worked against him up in the Carolinas. And of course, when we come out to Texas to work the Funk show, of course, the Briscoes, being from Oklahoma, were Natural Hills, and the Funk were the babyfaces. So we did a finish one night in Lubbock or El Paso, one of those towns, really hot heat town that John and I talk about all the time. When you get that heat where it just goes solid and you just feel it on top of, you know, that heat that you work your butt off.
Yeah.
And so we had one of those heat like finishes, and all of a sudden that ring there in Lubbock started filling up, man. You know, I'm crowding as close to my brother as I can. We're back to back. All of a sudden we look out in the crowd and there's a damn void starting, like a tidal wave starting towards the ring. We look and it's Killer Carl Cox, and he's got that 8-foot chain, and he's swinging and swinging and swinging. He gets right up to the ringside. He said, "Get under me, guys." Jack and I were both under the Killer. He swung out, man. That chain's like one little tow truck chain, man. Yeah. You know, he hits you with it. You're going to end up in a damn hospital. And those fans knew not to mess with Carl, you know, and they did, yeah. Man. But what a guy he was, and what a guy to build heat with. I mean, he was one of those old masters, John, that just, you know, give him 10, 15 minutes, he'd tell a story out there, and he would do nothing.
Yeah.
Except he would stay on your ass, and you knew he was on him, but he didn't do nothing, and he'd have the most heat of anybody on the card.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, his psychology was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
You know, people don't realize how much heat you had back in those territory days, which I was at the end of. I wasn't there at the, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, when right before national television, and how over guys were. You know, we had Bobby Rich on here. We had Kevin Von Erich. I mean, you had some guys that were just rock stars in these territories. One of the guys that was a rock star that people don't realize unless you looked at the history or know the history was JYD. And I didn't realize until I saw one of your interviews that he was one of your best friends. He was the best man in your wedding.
Yes. Yeah. And a great guy. Now, JYD was not, you know, he was not a, you know, like a, your classic wrestler. JYD's gift was charisma. I mean, he had charisma coming out, you know, come out his rear. And he was great on the microphone, and he looked great, you know. And I remember when I had been a baby face, you know, and everybody knew about the relationship, you know, territories are like that. Word travels, and, you know, the fans always saw us traveling together and what have you. And when I first turned heel, I turned on him. And so I remember, I told Grizzly Smith, I said, "Grizz," and Grizzly Smith is Jake Roberts' dad. He was one of the, you know, was it Kentucky. One of the Kentuckians or something?
Kentuckians, yeah.
And so, you know, he was like the guy that took care of the front office and got the money and all that, gave all the boys their finishes. And so I told Grizz, I said, "Listen," I said, "the first time I wrestled JYD in New Orleans, I am not driving my car down there." And he said, "Why?" I said, "Why?" I said, "Because it'll be on bricks when I come out." And he said, "Well, okay, ride with me. I'm neutral." I said, "Okay, I will." So we go down there, and I told JYD, I said, "Listen, buddy," I said, you hit that door on a dead run. When you slide in, I'm going to run. You chase me around the ring, roll in, and I'll, you duck my clothesline and come off and start pounding me until I say stop. And I said, then I'll load the glove, knock you out again, and we'll see him again next week. So anyway, we have this match. I get back in the dressing room. I'm showered and everything. Old Grizz comes walking in. He's got his hands on his hip, just shaking his head. And I said, Grizz, what's wrong? He's just shaking his head. I said, something wrong with the match? He said, no, the match was great. I said, what's wrong? He said, they slit my tires, all four of them. I said, you see? I said, they only slit your tires. I wouldn't have had tires on my car. But yeah, the heat, man, I tell you what. And Watts would tell you, I mean, it wasn't just Watts. I don't care what territory you in. If you were a heel, you damn sure better not get beat up in a bar fight or you're fired.
Right.
Yeah, that was the rule everywhere. You know, you get any fight you want to get in, but if you get in a fight and you get your butt kicked, you better not show up for work the next day. You better be gone.
That's
Teddy, I read where you were in a lot of lose or leave town matches.
You know, it's amazing how many of us heels lost lose or leave town matches all over the world.
You kept U-Haul. Was you one of those guys that drove up to the arena with the U-Haul trailer behind you? No,
but I've heard that story. the first time I went to Georgia, you know, there was, I remember Terry, you know, it was Terry, I think they called me, Terry Funk called me. And he said, hey, Teddy, he said, I want you to, you know, we want you to get to Georgia, get on that TV, because at the time that was the only like national, national network wrestling, where you could see wrestling from anywhere in the country, the superstation. And he said, because, you know, there's a possibility, he says, your name's in the hat, you know, you and a guy named Ric Flair and a guy named Dusty Rhodes, you know, for possibly being the NWA world champion at somewhere down the line. And he said, so go to Georgia and get over. So, okay. So I moved to Georgia, and, Georgia was the easiest territory I ever worked. I went back to my apartment every night. That was unheard of. You know, and there was a couple of guys named Briscoe that came along while I was in Georgia. And I can't remember exactly how this all went down, but I know that I had the beginning of a cauliflower ear. You're going to have to fill me in here, because I don't know what you guys talked to me into or told me was going to make it better, but all it did was make it worse.
You did it all wrong, John. Here's a story. Now we're traveling around, and Teddy comes over from Texas to Georgia, where there's some Smokies there, and you know we're a little tight, we're a little stiff, and so Teddy starts developing a cauliflower ear. Which, you know, we grew up with them because we wrestled those Oklahoma guys all the time. We were tough, so our ears were tough. But Teddy's tender Texas ear started getting cauliflower. So, you know, we're out one night having a few adult beverages, you know, and it's getting a little late. And it's cold as hell in Georgia. And so we walk out, and you've never had one, Layfield, but if you ever had a cauliflower ear in that cold weather, that stuff in there gets cold, and it starts solidifying. So hey, Teddy, right up here at the damn all-night drugstore, we could go in there and we get a number 3 syringe and some peroxide.
That's what it was.
And so somehow, you know, we had all that all beverages. That DiBiase agrees, we're going to drain Ted DiBiase.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. That's what it was. You know, here's the thing, John. What they neglected to tell me was that when they drained my ear, it was going to fill up bigger. It was going to get bigger.
So that night, your wife had gone to visit her relatives, and she had accidentally locked you, I think accidentally, but locked you out of the damn house. So we had to break in his apartment. Here we have syringes, you know, we might look like drug dealers or something. We're breaking in Ted DiBiase's apartment through the rear window back there. We get in. Finally, I get an ice cube out, and I said, okay, set it up, freeze your ear. You know, freeze my ear, damn, it'll hurt. Freeze your ear. So he froze the ear. Jack got the syringe all clean and ready. We stuck that syringe in. Man, we drained out. We must have drained out 20 cc's of that old stuff. There. And we even did it the right way. We put a compression on it so it wouldn't get big. But, you know, during the night sleep, he pulled the damn compression off, and the next day a damn ear was three times the size it was. Hey, Teddy, I know how to drain air to hell. You're not draining my ear anymore. And you still got the ear to show for, right?
Yes, I do. There it is, right there.
Jerry, do you not feel bad about impersonating a doctor?
You know what? I don't feel bad about that. I felt great about giving Ted DiBiase a wrestler's ear that he can go around and brag about. You know? Because you guys in Texas, you know, that hand-to-hand combat, you kind of turn the other cheek there, so to say.
Oh, gosh. Man.
So, Ted, during that time that you were Mid-South, was that when you tagged with Doc? You tagged with Doc, right?
Yes, yeah, that's when I thought, you know, and Doc came, I mean, he came right out of the University of Oklahoma, you know, into wrestling. And Doc was one of the nicest guys. I mean, he and I got really close, and we traveled. And actually, you know, Bill kind of put him with me at the time, you know, to kind of, you know, help him along and groom him. But, you know, this guy was, he was one of those guys that he didn't realize how tough and how strong he was. He was just natural. And what a great guy, man. It was like, I remember one night, we were on the road. I can't remember where we were going, but we pulled out of town and these guys were horsing around the road. We'd go to pass them and they'd speed up, And so he said, "Are you buckled in?" And I said, "I'm buckled in now." And he says, "Okay, watch this." So we start to go like you normally do. And, you know, and they kind of pulled out. And so he went around them on the other side. And he went around on the right side, and it was just like a 4-lane road. So he's on the shoulder. And so he gets in front of them and he said, "Okay, hang on." And he slams on the brakes. And you can, I'm waiting for the impact. They got stopped. So Doc gets out of his car and goes back. He's shaking. So you should have seen the look in the faces of these guys when these two big fucking guys get out of the car, right? And so he goes over there too, and he just takes his fist and goes over the top and makes a bird bath out of the hood of that car. And they never moved. They were rolled up. They were locked in. And they were just praying that that's all he was going to do. And so he said, we get back in the car, we dig off. And he looked at me like a little kid, that funny laugh he'd do. He'd go, that was Doc, man. But he was the greatest. And he was a hell of an athlete, man. Wow.
Yeah, he was one of those guys that Bill Watts didn't want to keep in a training camp too long either. He was in and out before, so Bill could take full advantage of all of his college credentials and everything. Right. But yeah. what a natural he was. I mean, he had that killer look, that size, and he had that intensity in the ring, and you believed everything that he did because you had to.
Well, and that's the other thing, Gerald, is as you know, this is like. You know, this is the 70s. You know, by that time, if you were a college athlete, you had picked your sport. You were either going to be a football player or a baseball player or a wrestler or whatever. Steve played, he played football for OU and wrestled too.
Right, right.
And I think I heard, I can't remember, what was his coach's name?
Stan Abel.
Stan Abel. Yeah.
Stanley Abel was his name. Hey, Teddy, he caused a riot at OSU when he was still in college. Did you guys ever hear about that? Pull it, you can find it on Twitter or one of those, Google, one of those things out there in the cloud out there. But anyway, he was wrestling this big star OSU guy, you know, heavyweight, and his brother just, I think, was in the stands. And, so Steve comes out, and there's some tussling around. And Steve was one of these guys in college wrestling, even that, you know, he didn't always stick to the rules. And of course, things got a little rough on the edge of the mat. There in Oklahoma, they call when OU and OSU do any sports, it's called Bedlam because the place is so crazy. And when they had those OU-OSU dual matches, they would draw, you know, 15,000, 20,000 people. And the people were literally right up against the damn mat. So they went jostled out to the side and Steve slammed the OSU guy one time unnecessarily. So the next time they're kind of tossing around, they get over this other side. Steve slammed the guy again, and his brother jumped out of the damn stand. And before the brother could get his fist up, Steve had dropped him. And the shit was on. A riot at a college wrestling match called by Steve Williams.
Oh, man.
So Steve Williams dropped him in the middle of his own match.
In the middle of his own arena, man. Arena.
What a great guy, though, man. I tell you what, I miss him. I really miss him.
Yeah, and he became – what a great tag team he became with Gordy. You know, when he went to Japan after that and was there with Gordy, that was one of the great tag teams. You know, you had great tag teams, the Steiners to work with them. You had him and Gordy. What a great time. And he was such a star over there. I mean, people don't realize how good Steve Williams was.
Yeah, that's true. And hey, and Terry Gordy. Gordy was a hell of a worker. Oh my gosh. Is that's who you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Bam Bam. Gordy, yeah.
Yeah, Bam Bam.
You're talking about two guys 300 plus over 6 foot tall and that could go like a damn junior heavyweight and fight you like a Stan Hansen until you couldn't stand anymore. Those they were just phenomenal athletes, generational type people.
Bill Watts, when Terry and I were working against each other, we were this is after I guess I had turned back babyface. And that's another story about me being a heel there for so long and Watts turned me babyface overnight. But anyway, me and Gordy were going around the territory. And so he gets this off and he says, look, he says, here's what I want you guys to do this week. And he says, I'm going to tell the rest of the talent, not to leave, but to stay and watch. He said, what Bill was noticing was the increase in high spots, more and more high spots. He said, I want you guys to tell a story. He says, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to go 55 minutes each night and then give them the finish. It'll blow everybody's mind. And you never saw two guys volunteer to do a job faster.
No good.
We did it, though.
Yeah. Take us to when you and Stan were teaming up over there. Were the matches a little brutal with Stan and that Japanese style wrestling over there?
Oh my gosh! I mean, they said the Japanese there are pretty snug. No, they're not just snug; they're stiff.
Yeah,
and their rings aren't as bouncy as ours are. They're not a good. They're real okay, but they still, but. Now Stan and Brody as a team had been so over. And so he came to me one night and he said, Bruiser's going to jump ship. He's going to go to work for New Japan, which at that time was pretty much unheard of. And so he says, I need a new partner. He says, do you want the job? I said, are you serious? He said, well, I wouldn't ask you if I wasn't serious. Uh-huh. I said, hell yeah, I'll take that job. And so I went from like one trip to Japan a year to I don't know how many trips. And, now I'm going, this is before the $1 million, man. I'm getting first class airfare and paid really well. But Stan was just, he was the machine that's going. And the other thing is Stan, when he takes his glasses off, he can't see shit.
Right.
He can't see anything. He's looking around like this, where are you? And so, being his partner, I was trying to not get hurt. Being his partner, I'd hold somebody up and he'd come through and he'd hit him with the lariat and we'd both go down. But the two of those guys were a huge commodity. And I just adopted his gimmick. I put on the chaps and the whole deal. I went all the way Texas, man. And we had a good time. And that's what I was in the middle of when this opportunity came up. And like I told you the story about, I was talking to Pritchard in the back of the Houston Coliseum. And I was about to go to Japan. And he said he was going to go see about getting a job. And that's when that whole thing happened. And when I left there, I hadn't been, we really hadn't been together that long when the opportunity to go WWF came along. But Baba, Baba was great. He said, thank you very much. He says, whenever you want, he says, the door's open to come back. So anyway.
So take us to that story, Brother Love calling you and telling you that, Vince wanted to talk to you. Set up that meeting, set up that that first meeting with this dream type character that you were presented. Well,
okay, so I come back. Well, I had that conversation with Bruce, while I was still in Japan. So I come home and I'm just kind of waiting, it's because I didn't even go back to work there because, Crockett was running the show now, and I wasn't going to sacrifice myself on the altar for him. And so the phone rings one day and it's Vince. And he said, Ted, I got an idea. He says, it's something that's never really been done before. And he says, and I think you might be the man for it. He said, I'd like you to come up here and talk to, so anyway, I flew up there the first time by myself. All the pleasantries and everything. and again, he went through the spiel about, it's a fresh idea. So many things in wrestling have been done and rehashed. He said, but this is pretty fresh. And he says, I think you're the guy for it. And he says, but here's the deal. He says, I can't tell you what it is unless you agree to come on board because I'm not going to give away a great idea. And so, it's like Terry told me, he says, don't snap at it. Like, he says, stay a little reserved. So I said, well, I'm going to go home and talk to my wife about it. And I'll get back to you. And he said, okay. So, I go home and talk to Melanie and then I call Terry and he said, Teddy. He says, if the man says he's got something, an idea that's tailor-made, he thinks for you, he says, pack your bag, go, and don't look back. He says, that's what you need to do. And so I called Vince and I said, okay, I'm your guy. I'm your guy. I'm on. I'm in. And I said, so tell me, what is it? So he said, I'm not going to tell you on the phone. So he flies me and Melanie, my wife, up the next time. And we get the red carpet treatment, first class, the limousine picks us up, takes us to the office. And so he kind of laid it out there. He said, the one thing everybody hates is someone by virtue of their wealth who thinks they're better than everybody. They bully people with their wealth. And I said, I kind of hate guys like that myself. So, and he said, what we're going to do is we're going to try to make the public believe you're really the guy. And I said, how are you going to do that? He said, well, we're going to fly you everywhere first class. You're going to have limousine service every night in every town. And then this guy comes walking in and counts out $2,000 brand new $100 bills and says, this is your flash cash. He says, I don't care if you buy a stick of gum, pay for it with $100 bill. People just hate, they'll really hate you because you got to make change for that. So, and he says, but now he says, go into a restaurant, get up and announce yourself, tell everybody who you are and that that's their lucky day because you're picking up the tab, and we'll have somebody that's always there with you. And because Virgil wasn't on the scene yet and he'll go around and pick up all the checks, you slap down the $100 bills, bring us the receipt. And we'll replenish the money. He says, now, if you abuse it, obviously you lose it. So he says, pick your spots. But imagine that. Right. And so like when I went back and got and then he said, okay, he says, we've got your room at the Helmsley Palace in Manhattan. And I says, and the limousine is yours. You're free to go anywhere you want. And and wherever you want to have dinner tonight, it's on us. And when I got in the car with my wife, I said, you're not going to believe this. You are not going to believe this. And it was unreal. And fast forward to, you know, some of those times when I would do that, there were a few times it was in a bar, you know, where, okay, it's a round on, you know, buy a round or whatever for the house. It's on the $1 million man. And so, you know, when Rick came along, got on board, I said, Rick, you know, there's a big difference between you and me. And he says, what's that? I said, you're spending all your money. I'm spending Vince's. It's called marketing.
And Pat Patterson had told you that this was basically Vince's idea if he could be the wrestler, right?
Exactly. Pat told me if Vince could be a character in his own show, this is who he'd be. And in so many ways, outside of getting in the ring, of course, he did get in the ring eventually a couple of times. He did become that character, you know, as he was on television more. I think anyway.
John, did you get that same deal when you became the Texas oil millionaire?
How did I miss out on this? I didn't get
you're a lousy negotiator.
Get any of that. I was a working millionaire. Ted was like the real deal.
You let me negotiate your contract is what happened. I think you let me negotiate your contract.
Yeah, that's exactly what
happened.
You signed.
And I got the money.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and eventually, you know, over time, you know, just until it gave it enough time to, get that word out there, you know, and of course, you know, I didn't have limousines every night, everywhere. Then, you know, it evolved into, he saved the limousines to, you know, to like, you know, he says, you know, when you go, you know, when you, of course, if you rent, you know, if you're going to rent a car, rent a big one, you know, go rent a Cadillac, you know, that Virgil drive. And they would save the limousine rides for the four big shows we had back then. You know, SummerSlam and WrestleMania and what have you. But I mean, it's like, you know, it was surreal. It really was.
You just said something that's really interesting. Four big shows. I mean, you know, when you think about it now, and we're monthly big shows, but back then you worked for four big shows, SummerSlam, WrestleMania, King of the Ring, and Survivor Series.
Right. And I don't see that. That's what I don't understand about, you know, the way business is today. It's like there's nothing to anticipate. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the world champion. You know, the NWA world champion. You know, as a territory, you might see two or three times, or maybe four times a year. You know, you didn't see him defend his title every week on television. Yeah. Anyway, that's another story. Well, WrestleMania 4 was the tournament. You know, that was the lead into that. You know, it's kind of like back to Andre. You know, we call it giving the guy the rub. You know, you see somebody that's got great talent, and so you put him with somebody that's established to help give him more status. And so that was given to me by Andre. I mean, Andre and Hogan wrestled at WrestleMania 3. They didn't touch again until Market Square Arena. First time wrestling was on live national network television since the 50s. And the main event was Hogan and Andre. And of course, the storyline was, I had said I can buy everything, including the world title. Andre's going to beat Hogan and sell me the belt. And so we did the screw on Hogan, and I actually wore the belt. I actually defended it one night against Bam Bam Bigelow somewhere. And I'm still not happy about it, because my title run has not been verified. But anyway, so that was the buildup. That's what are we going to do? You know, we can't give it back to Hogan because he technically lost it. Can't give it to Andre because he won't take it. He's been paid off. So that's how the tournament to declare a new champion came about. And I ended up in the last match with with Savage and made him the next champ. But and then because of the association with Andre, I mean, for a long time, I don't know if it was a year, you know, it seemed like a year. It was a good long time. Andre and I were together and we wrestled Hogan and any one of a number of guys. So I traveled around a lot with Andre for about a year. And I don't remember much of that year.
I don't, I bet you don't. Was that when was Timmy White driving you guys around also at the time, or was it still Frank?
Timmy was with him, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was with him, but yeah, there was always somebody, and that's who it was. It was Tim White who was with him all the time.
Yeah. And I heard great the story guy. When you got you ended up after that creating the own $1 million belt, which was a story in and of itself, but you worked your character 24/7. So when Virgil was at the airports, it was always a work. You know, he would load your bags for you because that was working the character. He left, or you left, somebody left the $1 million belt and a gold Halliburton at the Atlanta airport one time, right?
Yep. Huh. That was Bonehead. Yeah.
Bonehead.
Bonehead, yeah. You know, it's kind of like, we went to a baggage claim and you know, so I said, I sat it down for him because that's what I always did. He would load the bags and he'd put them in the limo and go. And so we get to the hotel and I go, where in the hell is the briefcase? And we got in that car and I said, get back to the Atlanta airport, you know, and I don't care how. I said, if you get a ticket, I'll pay for it. Just get there. Yeah. And thank God it was there.
Wow.
Thank God it was there. It was like, I went to the carousel and it wasn't. And then I went to the Delta, you know, guys, you know, I said, you guys haven't seen a gold Halliburton briefcase, have you? And he smiled at me and he reached down. He said, does it look anything like this? And I went, oh my God. Oh God. True story though.
And true story. That title was worth apparently around $40,000, right?
That's, yeah, they, you know, all the stones in the belt, there's 700 small stones in the face of the belt. And then there's a couple of bigger ones, but all the stones are cubic zirconium. The rib was though on the back of the belt on the top side, there's three real diamonds on the back. And when I saw that, I said, what's that? And they said, oh, those are real diamonds. And I said, and he said, well, if anybody ever asks you, are the diamonds real? You could say yes, and you won't be lying.
Details.
Details.
It was just amazing to me how, you know, I don't know what the secret is now. You know, I don't know if it's, you know, but when guys were heels, when I was a heel, you were in character 24/7. And it wasn't like you were trying to fool somebody. It was, yeah. Just, you know, if I go to see a Broadway, I don't want to know that the Phantom of the Opera is a waiter at Del Frisco's. You know, I don't care. I want to get into the play. I want to believe that. And that was what you did by living that character 24/7, which, you know, I understand things change, but, you know, people, the hardcore fans are the ones that show up at the airports, are the ones that show up for baggage.
Right.
To me, that was where you always needed to stay in character because they're the ones that can see you and say, oh, Ted DiBiase is really a good guy. We're not going to boo him tonight. And once you start getting those guys, you know, that's why we thought it was important to stay in character, which I know times change, but you felt the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. And I mean, I was raised in the business in my father's era. And, you know, you didn't break kayfabe, you know, you were it. Same thing. You know, and of course, it's kind of like, you know, I think anybody, if you're an athlete of any kind and you watch long enough, you might go, well, yeah, you know, I just don't know. But that's just like a magician. You know that he really didn't make a damn elephant disappear, but he did. Well, how the hell did he do it, though? Right. And when you walk in a movie, you know, it's a movie. But if the actors are really good at what they do, they draw you into to the story and what's it. And that's the other thing I think that's missing today is the talent today. And maybe it's not their own fault. you know, John, the way you and I and Gerald learned the business is doing it night after night after night. And we were in front of a live crowd every night, and you might do something one night and it worked real good. You do it the next night and go, that didn't get over. Well, that's when you realize that not every crowd is the same, and that if they don't respond to what you're doing, you better think on your feet and shift gears and do something else that they do buy. And
Teddy, not only was your in-ring character so good, but your out-of-the-ring character, the way you were presented, you know, and the work that I believe it was you and Bruce that did a lot of those vignettes, you know, that character really developed the heat as you go along. The basket, the kid with the basketball, you know, and the other was that you would disappoint, you'd let the kid, hey, I'll give you $100, $500 bouncer ball, what, 12 times, and then you kick that ball out. Yeah, I mean, you were doing those live. Do you feel the heat when you were doing that? Because I was watching TV, you were the meanest damn guy in the world.
Well, and, you know, and that's that particular one, too, the thing with the kid in the basketball, I hear about that more than any of them. And this is a true story, too. So let's fast forward. Now, of course, all those people that participated in those skits we did were paid by the company. Right. And so
fast forward. Why are you turning baby face?
yeah, well, it's about time. You know, I'm getting so old, I don't know if I can defend myself anymore.
That's so, right.
So I actually flew to Omaha, where I was, you know, from sort of, and I was speaking somewhere anyway. I was renting a car. So this guy comes up and taps me on the shoulder, and I turn around, I'm looking at his chest. I mean, I'm 6'4", and went, oh my gosh. And he said, hey, Mr. DiBiase, I'm the manager here. He says, can I help you find a car? I said, yeah, sure, man, find something that would fit both of us. And so he said, I'd be happy to. And then he just looked at me, because he said, do you remember that thing you did with the kid in the basketball? And it was just the expression on his face. And I went, no. And he said, it's nice to see you again.
Oh, wow.
I said, are you kidding me? He says, is it really you? And he said, yes, sir, it is. And his name was Sean. And so, golly, man.
That's amazing.
And then he said, you're really going to love this. He said, I actually went to college on a basketball scholarship. I said, see what I did for you, kid? And I got his information, but I lost it. If they could find that guy, I know the company would do a story on him. I know they would, because of all the skits we did, that's the first one everybody brings up, because, you know, it was so good. And that was Monsoon's idea.
Was it?
Well, yeah, we were in Milwaukee.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we were in Milwaukee, and they said, well, what are we going to do with Ted? You know, what kind of skit can we do? I said, well, what's Milwaukee famous for? Somebody said beer and basketball. And I said, well, we can't do anything with beer, but so let's do something with the basketball. And then Monsoon stepped in, and he says, how about if you do this? And there, the rest is history.
You know, well, hell, I would have volunteered for the beer. I'd drink 13 beers, and he could squash that last beer. And we'd all been happy. Probably wouldn't have had to pay me.
And people would ask me about, you know, me stealing your gimmick, which of course I did. And I would tell them the difference is, I said, here's the difference. I said, overall, we're pretty equal. I said, I was not near as good as Ted in the ring, but the Bashams in Orlando were a lot better than Virgil. So overall, we're equal.
I cannot complain. I mean, I can't, you know, there's no argument there.
No, Virgil, people give him such a hard time, and I understand why, but yeah. He was a great supporting character for you.
Well, yeah, and he did, you know, and he did what he's paid to do. I mean, he stood there most of the time with his arms folded, and to his credit, I mean, he had a phenomenal body, and you don't get that way or stay that way by being stupid, but you know, he did a good job. He didn't, he didn't have to do much, but WrestleMania 7, I think, was out in LA, and I had, I said, you know, who'd you wrestle at WrestleMania that year? Virgil. Huh. when I came back through the curtain, one of the boys looked at me and he said, "Damn, DiBiase, you can work with a broom." Oh, man.
A lot of things in the ring. Good would probably not be one of them.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So, John, you just touched on the subject, John. Tell us how you actually stole the Million Dollar Man gimmick.
Well, you know, what's funny about it is I didn't hear it from Pat or Bruce, but I heard it from somebody that my character was pretty much like what Vince would do at that time if he could get in the ring, was the JBL character. And it was absolutely a ripoff of Ted. You know, Ted had such great success as that heel. It was just a modern day version of it, which fit me better, being the West Texas guy who made money in the stock market and the big, you know, foghorn, leghorn, blowhorn.
Yeah.
But everything else, the work wasn't the same, but the chicken shit heel type character was the same.
Yes. Yes. And that's, you know, to me, that's just it. It's there's two kinds of heel. There's the hardcore, you know, tough guy heel. And eventually that guy will end up turning baby face, because bottom line is people like a tough guy. But that guy that runs his mouth and everything, and then, you know, gets that look on his face when somebody actually steps up to the plate. You know, like, oh, you know, I didn't really mean it. Like, and you just never get tired of seeing him get his ass kicked. And correct. That's just it. You're never going to lose your heat.
Teddy, did you ever get any feedback on JBL's character when he was doing it? I'm sure you did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, people told me about it.
What was your reaction to it?
More power to him. You know,
did you have an analogy? Well, this is the redneck Texan trying to
steal. Well, out. Yeah, I said, well, JBL is a redneck cowboy version of the Million Dollar Man.
Huh.
And then after me, Jerry, I got a great picture of Ted, me, and Alberto Del Rio.
Yeah, I remember that.
The three generations of stolen gimmicks. So it's Del Rio had all the exact same gimmick for a while.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
did a great job with it.
And did a great job. Yes,
yeah. I did a tremendous job. And I remember sitting there, I was sitting there around ringside one day. You know how we always sit around? And there was Ted and Del Rio. And I said, oh my goodness, this is too good. We got to take a picture of this. Three generations of stolen gimmicks with the only OG, Ted DiBiase.
Oh man!
But I didn't get the cash in the limos. I don't know how that didn't translate to 2004. I was in a
hurry. I don't know, man.
But you got the Learjets instead.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Ted, did you ever dream? I saw an interview you did about how you saw the wave coming. I mean, you were in line. They were talking about you being an NWA champion. You knew that Vince was the guy that was about to win the territory wars. Did you ever dream that the character that you were going for would end up being this character that, I guess, what, 30-something years later, people still remember the kid in Milwaukee with the basketball? People still remember Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man. Did you ever dream that this was going to be a lifelong thing for you?
No, brother, I didn't. I had no idea. And it still, to this day, amazes me. It's kind of like, especially, I tell you, I remember a couple of years ago, you know, I went over to the UK and I did a Comic-Con, actually two. One was in Sheffield in the UK, and the next weekend, it was in Glasgow, in Scotland. And so I was going to be there for a week. So whoever was driving me around took me to their equivalent of a Walmart, because I was going to pick up a few things, going to be there a week. So I'm walking in, and this kid walks out with his, I don't know whether it was his mother or his grandmother, and he couldn't have been, you know, 10 years old. And as he walked by me, he went, "Grandma, that's the Million Dollar Man." I went, "No way." And I turned around and I looked at him. And of course, you know, back then I had the highlighted blonde hair. You know, I didn't wear glasses. So I was now, I mean, I'm you know, nobody recognizes me now. who are you, you old fart? Anyway, But this kid recognized me, and I said, "How do you know me?" And his first response was video games. And then, you know, the internet, watching the old shows. And I was just amazed by that. Of course, I hadn't seen any modern video games. And actually, until about a year ago, they had what they call a gaming con. And I went to it, and I'm on a lot of video games, I know, but I've never played a game or even looked at them. But the characters look so lifelike now, it's incredible. But that's what his response was. And I mean, I remember standing there thinking, I mean, this kid wasn't even alive when I was doing my thing, and he knows who I am. That's just crazy.
Yeah, and he had that iconic laugh, like Ron Simmons has the iconic damn. You know, you've got something that's going to live forever that you always will be able to come on television and do.
I tell everybody that. I said, a 19, almost 20-year active career. I've been to all these different places and all these different things. And what in the hell am I going to be remembered for? That's it.
But you know, it's the greatest thing ever, Ted. You know, I had kind of a similar career type thing. And I wrestled in Japan, it's all blood and guts, wrestled in Europe. And you finally make money doing the old chicken shit heel. You start doing that. And it's the greatest thing ever.
It is.
People hate that guy. That's the greatest heel to play. You're tough when you're on top, and when you're on bottom, you're like, stop. You're just a coward.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, that's what bullies are, It's like I've taught my boys. I said, and just the way my dad taught me, he said, I don't want you to ever start any fights. If I find out you're starting fights, I said, then you're going to have a fight here when you get home. You're going to fight me. He says, by the same token, he says, don't let anybody bully you. And he said, here's the thing about bullies. Bullies are actually cowards, because most of the time when anybody steps up and challenges some bully, they will back down. And I have found that pretty much to be the truth. But that's why everybody hates a bully. It's kind of like, you're a loud mouth, bragging SOB. And when it comes right down to it, don't hurt me.
Ted, you just described a heel like a heel should be. And that was a thing I think both you and JBL have something in common. Neither one of you guys minded being that heel. I mean, a lot of guys, I don't want to be that heel. My family this, or my reputation. But you guys, I mean, you bought into the character. You was a character. You guys didn't mind being the heel. That's what separates a real heel from a guy playing a heel, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah, and I guess just in the business, that's the way I looked at it. I mean, of course, I grew up in that business, it's like I'm in the business. Well, just like when Pat came to me, Pat Patterson, because I never had any conversation with Vince or anybody about, nobody ever said, we're going to put the belt on yet, WrestleMania 4, nothing like that. I thought it was a possibility. But anyway, when Pat came to me, he says, I don't know, that might have been his idea. He said, look, he says, here's what we're thinking, or I'm thinking. He said, everybody's expecting that because you're the new hot heel that you're going to come away with this thing. He said, what if that doesn't happen? And in your arrogance, you make your own belt. You just declare yourself champion, and you make this big deal. As soon as he said it, I said, do it. I said, because that's going to put a ton of heat on me. And it's all about the heat.
Right.
It's all about the heat. It's like, if there's no heat, there's, what are you doing? And so that was it. It's like, I always looked at it as, like a businessman. And so that's why I didn't care. That's what he does. And the more you hate me, the more you're going to come, the more you're going to want. It's kind of like, I always said Muhammad Ali took a page out of wrestling and made everybody hate him. what I'm saying?
You're right.
Made everybody hate him. You never had a flamboyant boxer like that. And he was so flamboyant, and he, just same thing. Yeah. You,
We were at SummerSlam 1 year, and I was working with Undertaker, and we had a program leading up to it. And so I see it take sometime before SummerSlam, and he goes, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, up to you." And he goes, "Well, I figure I'm going to put you over with the clothesline." And I said, am I going to retire the next day? And he said, "Why?" I said, "Because you just killed me." And he goes, "Huh?" And I said, "If JBL brags all the way up to SummerSlam, I'll beat The Undertaker." I said, "If I beat The Undertaker," and he right away, he got it with us. You know, he was just wanting to do the favor. He was wanting to help out and, you know, build JBL. And he goes, "I got you." He goes, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want you to beat the living hell out of me. I want to chokeslam
you in
the limousine, and I'm going to brag to everybody that I beat The Undertaker for the next 6 months." And he goes, "Really? I love it. I love it." You know, he's trying to do the favor, but once he realizes, he goes, "I'm not used to working with a pure heel." But that's us. I mean, that's
what you guys were. Yes, Eddie Kadek.
Yeah.
Ted, how is, you know, I loved your son, Ted. We got along great, good looking guy, with great big traps. Is he happy not being in the business?
He's doing good too. You know, he's become, they said, what does he do? I said, he's an entrepreneur. He's got his hands into a lot of different things. He loved the business while he was there, but he saw what I was trying to tell him. I said, you're going to, especially if you're that good. I mean, you know, it's like everybody that's had that spot, you might only wrestle 4 days a week, but I guarantee you, if you're the guy carrying the banner of the company, then you're going to be doing a lot of appearances and you're going to be gone a whole lot more than you're going to be home. And when he started to see that, he said, I was really, I was shocked at first, but then I was also proud of him. He said, I don't want that. And plus, he knew me and he knew, my wife will tell you, I've always been a great dad, because when I was there, I was totally engaged in the lives of my boys. I wasn't out doing something else. I was, if anything, I was out in the yard with them playing ball, or them and their friends are doing something. And just that engagement, get on a red eye flight back home, get into Jackson at 9 o'clock in the morning from the West Coast. And the boys got a soccer game. Well, I'm dead beat tired, but I'm going to that damn soccer game, And so that was the deal. It was, he chose family over fame, and I was proud of him. So.
Yeah. What an incredible, that's a terrific thing for him to do. And he could have been a star. He had it. Good looking guy. He could wrestle. He could work. I mean, he could have been a star.
Well, somebody, I don't know who told me this, but somebody said that, in one of the stockholder meetings or something, Stephanie had made a comment. They said, Ted DiBiase Jr. may very well be our next John Cena. That's wow.
That's, I don't know. Big compliment.
So.
And then, anyway. Now you've dusted off the $1 million man. Has inflation made you a $1 billion man yet?
I don't know.
And you're back now at NXT with being the same character that you were from.
Oh gosh, yeah, they called me and said, "You want to do this?" And this kid, the other thing about this kid, Cameron Grimes, the character is funny, but and I'm about to turn him babyface too, but with what they're doing with it, but the similarities is that I asked him one day, I said, "How long have you been wrestling?" He said, "Since I was 14." I said, 14. He said, "Well, that's when I started getting in the ring and learning how to do the stuff." And I said, "Well, how was that possible?" He said, "Well, my dad was a wrestler slash, like a small time promoter too. So he also had a dad who had been in the business." So that's, I didn't realize I had that in common with him. But Trevor is his real name. And he's a good kid. Yeah.
Are you enjoying going down there and working with NXT and being
a wrestler again? Yeah. Yeah, I am, and I'm just, and I told him, I said, "Look, I'm available." I said, "If anybody, wants my opinion or you got a question, don't hesitate. I'm going to be here. I'm there for the TVs and I'm there all day, and I'm not, usually, my part in it's not huge, so I'm available."
Teddy, that's incredible. I'm sorry. That's got to be incredible energy. I've visited NXT to help with some of the tryouts and evaluations. The energy that you get from that NXT when you walk in and you can feel the energy of these kids, you know, striving to be the best that they can. And they're all begging for knowledge all the time. And that's what I really respect about these young guys, that they want the knowledge of the old timers. And I've seen them come in and respect the guys that, you know, that they don't know unless, you know, they've looked up somewhere, but they've taken the time to look them up and know something about them. But so they're teaching the right philosophy down there. They're teaching respect of guys like you and John and myself. And that, you know, it really feels good though to walk in there and feel that vibe.
Yeah, it is. They're doing a good job, you know, and it's, you know, just hopefully that as time goes on, it's, you know, this pandemic stuff will go away and they'll get more opportunity to get in front of a crowd and do it. And that's the difference. That's the one difference I see between our generation of wrestling and all of now. It's like, it's getting in front of that crowd and doing it. It's just hard to explain. I remember having a conversation with Terry Funk and Dick Murdoch, you know, riding back to Amarillo from Lubbock, Texas. And I, you know, this is again before I was working, and kept asking him questions. And Terry finally looked at me. He said, "Teddy," he says, you're not gonna understand this right now, but one day you will." He says, "I can't answer that question." He says, "Because it's generic. It's I do what I do on the fly. It's because I feel the moment. I can feel the crowd. Every crowd you get from is going to be a little bit different, and." You know, and at the moment I didn't understand it, but once I got in the business and had time to acquire that, then, you know, and that's, I think if there's something that these kids aren't getting, that would be it. Is there not enough time in front of the crowd?
Yeah. Cause anyway. Steve Kern was on the show with us and said it was like movement versus emotion. You know, when you have COVID and you have no crowd, there's no emotion. You know, they pipe it and they try to, you know, replicate it, but it's just movement. And you don't really learn what works and what doesn't until you get in front of the crowd. You think you do, and you think you know, but until you do, I think guys are going to be surprised what actually works and what actually doesn't, because there's no science to this. You think something is going to work, but you don't know until you get out there.
That's it. Well said. Well said, John.
And I'm just mad that another guy is stealing our gimmick.
Oh, hey, gosh.
Ted, thank you so much for coming on the show with us. It is such a treat. I just, you've always been so gracious to me, especially from a guy that stole your gimmick. So I want to.
Well, hey, hey, John, you did a hell of a job. You did a hell of a job, and you're I always looked at you as a pure heel, and that's just it. It's Jerry, you said it, you know, he didn't mind and I didn't mind.
We lost you.
You are.
Yeah, we lost you and came back. You scared us. Said, "Teddy, what do you got going on now? I mean, I know you were down at NXT, but your personal life, you've been involved with the ministry for a long time. What do you got going on?"
Well, again, I'm speaking. I speak in churches. I get invited to churches, and I get invited to a lot of men specific events. I speak into the lives of a lot of men. You know, about my faith and how I went from wrestling to where I am now. But I'm also still, you know, like tomorrow I'm getting on a plane and going to Raleigh, Durham, and going to sign autographs there for like a couple of days, you know, and make some money, you know, money. It's all about money.
Everybody has their price, Jerry.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about right now.
There you go. All
I
right.
Just love the smell of money. Don't you?
Every day. Well, we sure appreciate it. Like JBL said, Teddy, it's always a pleasure. You know, we've gone back as far as just about our entire career, knowing each other, traveling with each other, and laughing with each other. And you got that famous laugh and all. That I'm so happy that, you know, that made you a bundle of money.
Yeah, it did. You know what? And that was Vince. He was walking by one day. And I just happened to end a promo, and I laughed like that. He stuck his head in the door, and he goes, "That's my $1 million man." And that's what I want to hear every time you cut a promo. So Good insight on the boss. So got to give him credit.
We just got a scoop, Don.
We did just get a scoop. Ted, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Thank you for joining Jerry and I on our show.
Okay. Thanks very much.